Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we will talk about what really happened in the recent election and what progressives can do going forward. What is a winning message that will help Americans economically and help Democrats win in 2016? What changes in leadership happened this week in Congress, and do the leadership changes matter? What will the president do about immigration, and who will it help? What can we expect the Republicans to do as they prepare to take over majorities in the U.S. House and Senate? Here to help us understand all this and more is Harold Meyerson, one of the country's leading political analysts. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country, where he's worked for 12 years. He also writes a weekly op-ed column for the Washington Post, where he's been a columnist for 10 years. From 1989 through 2001, he was executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. His articles on politics, labor, the economy, foreign policy, and American culture have also appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Times, The LA Times, and many other publications. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
So I've been dying to talk to you about this election because I love your analysis, but the first thing out of the gate, we got to know that Democrats lost the majority in the Senate, they lost more seats in the House, they lost governorships, even in blue states. Why did the Democrats lose so badly?
Well, I mean, you know, in this case, defeat isn't an orphan. It has about 1,000 fathers and mothers. But I would say the largest single reason is that the economy has, for structural reasons, deteriorated for about 90 to 95% of the American people, mm-hmm. who are making less than they made in 2000 and less than or no more than they made in 1992. And when you're the incumbent, and even though the Republicans controlled one house of Congress, the House, generally the incumbent party is viewed as the president's party, and the economy doesn't get better on your watch, there is a price to pay. Now, of course, the irony here is that Obama had suggested in the course of his presidency a number of things, infrastructure spending, certainly one of them, that would have made the economy better for a lot of folks, and the Republicans shot it down. But you know, that's a detail. You know, in terms of assessing responsibility, the other thing is sort of the Democrats' problem of messaging. They didn't really run and. Much of an economic message about what to do for most folks. They did in places back raising particular state measures to raise the minimum wage, all of which passed, including passing in conservative states like Nebraska, South Dakota, Arkansas, even though while those voters were voting Republican. But there's even a larger question, which is that the Democrats are in really the same boat as all incumbent parties, and certainly the parties of the center left in Europe. And that is, since World War II, the sort of fundamental appeal of the Democrats is that we can create broadly shared prosperity, and at least we do it better than the Republicans do, or in the case of Europe, than the more conservative parties do. But all of the things in the Democrats' toolbox that historically enabled them to do that, unions, a minimum wage it kept up with the rising wages generally, a relatively structural, equitable distribution of corporate revenues and things like that, all of those have fallen apart. They essentially no longer exist. And so the Democrats, like the parties of the center-left in Europe, are in a kind of quiet intellectual crisis. How do they produce broadly shared prosperity again? They don't know, and that's, I'd say, the deepest root cause. I mean, there are all kinds of causes beyond that, including in some states voter suppression, in some states the Democrats having bad candidates, the general fall off of midterm voting compared to presidential year voting. But I think fundamentally the Democrats have run out of, I think there are ideas out there, but the Democrats have yet to embrace, and some of these ideas are new, they're nascent, what they've yet to embrace what they need to do to raise most people's incomes, and that's a pretty fundamental problem.
Yes, so that's very interesting. Now, you've mentioned kind of about the voter suppression, and clearly that's an issue. You think even beyond this, the big money problem, which a lot of people were talking about beforehand, the fact that $4 billion was spent on it, that there was the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court and McCutcheon decision, which allowed big money to spend in a big way without any attribution, sometimes not knowing where this money is coming from. You think in spite of the voter suppression and the big money, it's really more fundamentally the Democratic program, the Democratic messaging about how to create widely shared prosperity. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And, you know, the fact is in European nations where they don't have insane court rulings like Citizen United, and they don't have the role that big money plays in American campaigns, the parties that are roughly analogous to the Democrats are still suffering the same kind of problems. In fact, and some of them are facing worse problems. I mean, voters who used to vote for the left in France are now voting for far-right nationalist parties, and we see this kind of evolution in a number of countries. So I think that's a fundamental problem. You know, there's a poll today, Eleanor, that came out in the Wall Street Journal. It's a good poll. They employ a Democratic pollster and a Republican pollster. This is the NBC Wall Street Journal poll. And here's this disconnect. They asked the people they polled, do you feel positive or negative about this year's elections? And 53% said positive and 40% say negative. So that suggests maybe a kind of conservative shift among the American people. Then, though, it asked them what actions that you do you want the next Congress to take? Do you support the following list of actions? And so the actions that this presumably conservative electorate wanted the new Congress to take, number one is lowering the cost of student loans. Over 80% supported that. Number two, increased spending on road and highway projects. Over 70% supported that. Number three, raise the minimum wage. You know, the more conservative things, raise Social Security age, cut funding for health care law. These are the ones that came in last.
Hmm.
So how do you reconcile? an electorate which feels good about, a country that feels good about the election on the one hand, and whose policy priorities are essentially the Democrats' priorities, which the Republicans oppose? And the answer is the Democrats are just not connecting with people because there's a fundamental block. And the fundamental block, I would argue, isn't so much cultural like it used to be. I mean, oh, they're the party that supports, you know, gay marriage. Well, the American public has come around on that issue. It's that the party has been in power for some time, and people's lives are still more economically stressed. And when you're economically stressed, you're just plain stressed than they've been in years. That's a huge impediment.
Right. I think that's a very revealing poll. I was thinking about it after the election going. At first, I was very distressed going, what is going on in this country? How could these people be voting so against their own self-interest to be voting for the Republicans who have an agenda which largely benefits the pro-corporations as opposed to the pro-people? And then it dawned on me, I said, you know what this is? This is people voting for change. I mean, they're still voting for change. In 2008, they were voting for hope and change with Obama. He's had 6 years in there. I've had the Democrats controlling the Senate. And yet people haven't seen the kind of change that they need. And you wrote a very powerful op-ed in the Washington Post recently, where you talked about that, yes, Obama was successful in getting the economy going again, and the problem is that what's coming out of that growth is not being shared by people, that 95% of the income growth since the recession has gone to the wealthiest 1%. So in general terms, the figures could look good, but in actual fact for people's lives, like you say, they're very stressed and they want relief. They want action by the government. They don't feel they've had it under the Democrats' rule. So now they're turning to the Republicans going, well, maybe they can get it done. Is that what you see?
Yeah, absolutely. No, and you know, I mean, I think there are a range of policies that are being conceived or that are available to the Democrats as they go forward, but they're not really fully on the table yet, and they have to go there. And the Democrats have to navigate a tricky line, and that is this. If you look at the exit polling from the election, the poll of like 20,000 some voters that the networks conducted, you find 78% of that electorate, and it was a fairly conservative electorate, saying that they don't trust government or they trust it only some of the time, and that that's at different times in American history that waxes and wanes, but there's an American tradition. Certainly since the credibility gap opened during the Vietnam War of being wary of expansive government. You know, the Democrats challenge that most of the time at their own peril. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, the same people in the exit poll who gave that response were asked which statement they agreed with. Does the economic system mainly benefit the wealthy, or is the economic system fair to all? And 63% said that the economic system chiefly benefits the wealthy. Even 46% of Republicans said that. So the challenge for liberals generally, progressives, whatever you want to call us, is to come up with, you know, programs that really address that, that really address the clear economic populism that answer fairly screams at us in ways that, for now at least, don't really enlarge the government and therefore make them unenactable and unpopular. And I think there are such policies exist, but some of them, you know, are really on new terrain.
Yeah, and I want to get to those policies in a minute, but before we move to that, I have been concerned in reading the results of this election that some Democrats might say, as you indicated, you could consider this or interpret this as a conservative turn, that so many Republicans won in so many races, state and federal. Now, your poll information from the Wall Street Journal today indicates that if you scratch the surface under it, people actually want the Democratic program. It's just the Democrats haven't delivered it. But what are you hearing around Washington? Are you hearing the Democrats saying, well, actually, this is a turn to the conservatives, so we should become more conservative so we win next time? Or are you hearing? Go ahead.
I think you're seeing the traditional rifts in the Democratic Party on that question open up. Folks like Will Marshall, who is a former leader of the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, Al Fromm, who founded it, the people at Third Way have all argued that, yes, this shows that the Democratic Party has moved too far to the left. Mm-hmm. Then there are others who a lot of folks are saying that the Democratic Party didn't really have an economic message. This has become a theme, and that, you know, that the party, beyond advocating raising the minimum wage, doesn't really have a program to help most Americans economically. And I'm actually kind of surprised how widespread that message has become. Then there are some real divisions as to what the party can do to help Americans economically. I mean, they're, you know, I think the centrist position is, well, if everyone just had better education, we'd be better off. Well, I mean, yeah, so far as it goes, certainly that's true. But the real dividing line in the American economy today isn't between the well-educated and the less well-educated. It's between people whose income comes from investment and people whose income comes from their own work. So I think we, you know, have to go way beyond the notion that if we just had better schools, everything would be okay. That kind of skips over the fact that college graduates' incomes have been stagnant for many years, too, just like the incomes of people who haven't graduated college.
Fascinating. So let's turn a little bit to this question of the people are saying they want the lower student loans, spending on transit, raising the minimum wage. Democrats have been trying for years to get this since Obama came in. In fact, even on his inaugural election night 6 years ago, the Republicans had a meeting and said our strategy is going to be to prevent Obama from getting any victories in the Congress and prevent him from getting reelected. And they've had a deliberate policy or strategy of stopping and obstructing any progress in those areas. And we've had votes on this where, you know, either the Republicans stop a good bill for student loan reductions, they'll stop a good bill in the Senate, or they get it passed in the Senate and then it gets blocked in the Republican House. How is it possible? Are people that ill-informed that they don't realize that this is the very agenda that the Republicans have spent 6 years trying to block?
Well, I think there are two answers to that. One, the short answer is yes. And the longer answer is, since the usual reporting is that nothing ever happens in Congress and it's just a mess, so you don't follow it that closely there. And whatever goes on in Congress, you know that your own economic situation or your millennial kids who are living in your basement or whatever, their situation hasn't...
Now you're hitting close to home.
Oh, okay, all right. Yeah, no, actually, my daughter has a website on which she just posted a plan to get millennials out of your basement, one graduate at a time. That's what she called it.
That's a winning program.
Yeah, really, really. She should be running the Democratic National Committee. And she wasn't suggesting this in a political context either. But, the fact that that is the economic reality that most Americans face,
right?
Means that, there's the clear and simple answer is to vote against the incumbent. And in American politics, the incumbent is almost always perceived as the president. Now, I mean, there are some exceptions. If you recall, the Republicans took control of Congress in 1946, and when he ran for re-election in 1948, the Democratic president, Harry Truman, ran against what he termed the do-nothing Congress, and he won, and Democrats retook control of the Congress. So every now and then, if you really focus, and God knows Truman's 1948 campaign required focus because he was not expected to win, he ran a very smart campaign, you can get people to think of the Congress as the incumbent. Of course, the fact, up to now that we've had the Senate in control of the Democrats and the House in control of the Republicans makes that a little murkier message. But the Democrats really didn't try this time, and I think it will present an interesting option for the Democratic presidential nominee, now that Republicans control both houses of Congress, when he, or more likely she, is running for president 2 years from now.
Right, and I was surprised by that in this election, too. The Democrats, running like rats from a sinking ship, running from President Obama, when, in fact, he has a pretty good story to tell. If you look at the economic hemorrhaging that was happening when he first came in and the losing hundreds of thousands of jobs every month, and he stabilized the ship, getting more jobs happening, stabilized the economy. Now, clearly, the economic growth, as we discussed, isn't being shared widely, which is kind of the next stage that we need to be working on. But he passed the great signature piece is Obamacare, which it tends to be very popular. And, you know, people sometimes didn't like the idea of it when they heard of it from Republicans, but they actually like the policy of it, and they like being able to access affordable health care. And gas prices are down, not that he could claim any credit for it, but a president's always blamed when it goes up, so they might as well take credit when it goes down. But there were things that they could have talked about, and they didn't. Instead, running for cover, you know, Alison Grimes there in Kentucky for the U.S. Senate seat was neck and neck with Mitch McConnell, which would have been an enormous victory if she could have knocked out the minority leader out of the Kentucky Senate seat. And yet, when asked, who did you vote for, she wouldn't even admit she voted for him, and then said, well, this is what he's done right, and this is what I would do if I'm elected. So what's with the Democrats that they weren't more vigorous in defending what they've done or in explaining that more that they wanted to do, it was, you know, the Republicans had blocked them?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. First of all, you're right that when people are asked about the particulars of Obamacare, the policies in Obamacare, they support them. Once they find out that you're talking about Obamacare, they don't support it. That's a kind of contradiction that mirrors what I cited in today's Wall Street Journal poll. We like the idea that Republicans are in control, and all the policies we support are actually the Democratic policies that the Republicans oppose. Go figure. So that that aside, you know, I mean, there's a quote from the old Jewish prophet Hillel: "If I am not for myself, who shall be for me?" And I think some of the congressional Democrats would say, "Well, look, Obama didn't really defend his economic program that strongly, so how can you expect us to do that?" And I think they have a bit of a point there. Obama has not really made the case in recent years, I think that compellingly, for his economic program and economic vision. You know, the Democrats did not really make it clear that the sorts of things that people really wanted were what was being obstructed by the Republican House.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, look, are any of the Democratic campaigns in any of the states going to go down in playbooks for being great campaigns out of this year? Not many, you know. There were some who, you know, probably ran better than expected, but there were scores who ran worse than expected. And if you look at how the Republicans won governorships in solid Democratic states, such as Maryland and Massachusetts and Illinois, and then you look at the voter turnout, not where it was suppressed, but in places that are Democratic strongholds, referring to those three states, in Baltimore, in Boston, and in Chicago, turnout was really bad. And a couple of thoughts on that. One, this is exactly you know, what you would expect when the economy is really bad for urban minorities who simply didn't turn out and vote, and it's what you'd expect when the Democrats with limited resources are putting all their resources into what they see as swing states and kind of ignoring the states they assume they're fairly strong in normally. Didn't work, you know, particularly, I mean, Maryland, which is just ridiculous. I know there were some union people who about 10 days before the election suddenly realized Maryland was in peril, but by then it was too late. Now, a lot of that is just, you know, the weakness of the candidate, but there's more to it than that. There's a collapse of turnout in the Democratic base, because what's going well for the Democratic base these days? Not much.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of our shining lights through this campaign was Elizabeth Warren, and she was clearly the most popular Democrat out on the campaign trail everywhere, red states and blue states. And she was the one who, taking the message of taking on Wall Street, reducing student debt, expanding Social Security. Why do you think more Democrats weren't following her lead?
Well, they needed a knock in the head, and hopefully, if there's any positive outcome from the election, maybe it provides that knock in the head. I mean, you do find some Democrats these days now saying we need to do some of the stuff that Elizabeth Warren is talking about. I think there's a sense in which she has captured the hearts of the Democratic base. And obviously one of the very big questions for the Democrats is, where's Hillary Clinton on all of this? Because there were, you know, there was a campaign stop that Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren were both at in Boston on behalf of the Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Massachusetts, where Hillary Clinton, you know, went beyond Elizabeth Warren in the sort of, you know, you didn't make it, you know, we all made it sort of meme. And then she pulled back on it 2 days later when her, you know, I mean, she's also the candidate of many of the big banks that Elizabeth Warren excoriates. And so I would say Hillary Clinton's identity crisis is in many ways the Democratic Party's identity crisis. Yeah, we really go with the populism. And by the way, Elizabeth Warren's populism is what I was talking about earlier. It's not necessarily related so much to expanding government programs, except possibly the most popular, which is like Social Security. You know, it's about really dealing with the economic power relationships, and there's clear support for that. So that has pretty much captured the central message of the Democratic base. And then there are Democrats like Hillary Clinton and many others who have been massive recipients of Wall Street contributions. So where is the party anyway, and where is Hillary Clinton anyway? That's a, sort of a defining question before the Democrats over the next 2 years.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And if you look at it, you know, maybe before we could have drawn more sharp distinctions between the Republicans and the Democrats. You know, when I was growing up, it was the Republicans were the party of the wealthy and Wall Street, and the Democrats were the party of the people and the working people. And that has really muddied, and a lot of that has been muddied because of the Democrats looking for money from Wall Street and from the corporations, because elections are very expensive and are getting more and more expensive. So they think it's a practical matter. We need the money in order to win the election, as opposed to we need to do what's right to be done and speak on behalf of the people and know that there's actually, you know, you can have mobilization of voters can counter the impact of big money. But I think it's that blurring of the line within the Democrats because of accepting Wall Street money has made it hard for voters to see much of a difference sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it would be nice if the Democrats could follow the maxim of the late, great Jess Unruh, the Speaker of the California Assembly, in the heyday of California liberalism in the late 50s and 1960s. Unruh said, if you can't drink their liquor, take their money. And then he made some reference to women who the powerful, wealthy interests might provide legislators. If you can't do that and vote against them the next morning, you got no business being here. However, that's not how politics normally works. You know, I have one solution. And if you look at, you know, both the last two Democratic presidencies of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and try to single out where the flawed policies came from, or the policies that didn't go far enough, it tended to come from Treasury officials who were creatures of Wall Street, and who, under Clinton, refused to regulate derivatives, repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which made banks put banks and depositors' money at risk for the kind of speculation that the Glass-Steagall Act had forbidden. And in this administration, with Timothy Geithner, paid very little heed to the plight of underwater homeowners, didn't want that as big a stimulus as the economy needed. So, you know, if you think that one of the things the next Democratic president needs to do differently is not appoint Wall Street people to the most important economic positions in the administration, I think there's a useful lesson, and that is this. The most important policy advisor to Franklin Roosevelt when he first ran for president in 1932, and then for the first year of his presidency in 1933, was a Columbia University economist named Raymond Moley. And in his diaries, in Raymond Moley's diaries, we find this story that Roosevelt was, during the transition between his first election and his taking office as president, he was trying to decide who should be his Treasury Secretary. And some people were arguing for Carter Glass, a Democratic senator from Virginia, who in fact later on authored the Glass-Steagall Act. And Glass insisted that if he was going to be Treasury Secretary, he wanted as his Deputy Secretary a top banker at J.P. Morgan, which was sort of famously at the time headquartered at 23 Wall Street. So Roosevelt thought it over and then told Moley, no, we can't have anyone from 23. And, you know, I mean, the address of J.P. Morgan Chase today is 270 Park Avenue. The address of Goldman Sachs is 200 Freedom Plaza. I mean, we should have a demand for all the Democratic presidential hopefuls, so it's not, you know, it's not just Hillary Clinton, that they should take a no on 23 pledge. No major economic advisors come from Wall Street. I think that's a reasonable demand to make of Democratic presidential candidates. If you look at the performance of Robert Rubin and his proteges over the last two Democratic presidencies, that seems like a reasonable demand, and I think we should make it.
That's interesting. I wonder who besides Elizabeth Warren would step up on that one.
Well, I mean, there may be Democratic candidates running to the left of Hillary Clinton. The Bernie Sanders of this world.
Right.
Among others. But I think more to the point, you know, this should become something articulated by, or Move On and unions and everyone else. Seems like a reasonable demand for them to make of the Democratic field.
Interesting idea. I want to ask you one more question about this election, because there's been a lot of talk really for 6 years about the rising American electorate favoring Democrats, and that would be the assumed continued growth in the youth vote and Hispanics, and there was kind of this sense of, well, things may not be good now, but there's a steady march towards a stronger Democratic base, so we might win or lose a few here or there, but ultimately the trajectory is towards victory. But this election showed, that you actually have to give the rising American electorate a reason to vote. And what's your sense now after this election about the rising American electorate?
Well, I think it still gives the Democrats a leg up in presidential years. Turnout is a real issue. I mean, again, that's how you explain things like losing the governor's races in such solidly Democratic states as Illinois, Maryland, and Massachusetts. Turnout is critical, and the electorate may be rising, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to the polls. They may agree with you, but unless you give them something a little more concrete than that, it's not enough. So that's part of it. And then look, there is Republicans are probably going to continue to estrange many members of the rising American electorate. I think we're about to see it in their reaction to the speech that President Obama is going to give later tonight on immigration. Mm-hmm. But all that said, you need to give them some economic hope, some tangible economic programs, and you probably need to win back some more white working class voters who agree with you, would agree with you on economics if you address their economic concerns more effectively. So that's my two cents on that.
Right. Well, you know, it's the two different problems with the same solution. You mentioned the white working class that even with the rising American electorate tending Democratic, it doesn't their votes don't make up enough for the Democrats losing the white working class so big. So, you know, the Democrats need to have a message that's going to resonate and motivate the white working class and the rising American electorate to actually, as you say, rise up and go to the polls.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have a few. So there's a few interesting new policy ideas out there that might do that.
Well, let's talk about that now. You wrote a very powerful op-ed right after the election in the Washington Post called Blue Economics. And you actually, I think, laid out a program specifically of what the Democrats need to do. So I think, you know, maybe we can dispense with the hand-wringing and get on with the shaping of the economic program that's really going to help Americans and therefore have them more likely to vote for the Democrats who bring that program that bring economic relief and prosperity to them. So talk to us now. What are some of the specific economic policies that you think the Democrats can offer that would really help Americans and help them win?
Well, let me begin with an ordinance which was just passed by the San Francisco City Council last night. And people shouldn't be deterred by the fact that it's San Francisco. This is not cultural liberalism. It's anything but. As you know, a huge number of Americans who work part-time don't get their hours assigned until shortly before they're expected to be at work. Which makes things like, you know, being with your kids, planning on that, very difficult. So yesterday, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, as their city council is called, enacted by a 10-0 vote a retail workers' bill of rights, which had two parts. One part required local retailers to post well in advance the hours they wanted from their employees. And the part two said that when work picks up, when they need more volume of work, they're required to offer longer hours to their part-time workers before they hire more part-time workers. In other words, give more work to your part-time workers who want more. This seems to me to be something that is kind of a political no-brainer. I mean, I could see this extending way beyond San Francisco, just like on election day, San Francisco voted to raise a minimum wage as they did in Nebraska and Arkansas. I don't see any reason why this can't be a Democratic program in Nebraska and Arkansas as well, this Retail Workers' Bill of Rights. Then I've been kicking around an idea. As you know, in during the years of broadly shared prosperity, say the three decades after World War II, Americans' incomes increased pretty much at the same rate that productivity increased. In other words, the gains from productivity were shared by the workers who themselves were becoming more productive. That totally decoupled starting in 1973, and this pretty much explains a great deal of the wage stagnation that we've seen since the 1970s. So I had the notion that since corporate tax reform is a continuing subject of consideration on Capitol Hill and likely will be in the new Congress even more than it's been up to now, the Democrats should propose lowering corporate tax rates on companies that pass on the annual productivity increase to their workers in the form of a wage increase and raise corporate taxes on corporations that don't. Now, the fact that I suggested this is not all that significant, but the identical idea is being advanced by the guy who was really the intellectual light of the centrist or center-right Democratic Leadership Council, William Galston at the Brookings Institution. I mean, I think there's, you know, I think there's real running room on this. I'll cite another idea, a similar idea. There was a bill in the California State Senate last year, which got a plurality, not a majority, in the State Senate, that would have lowered the state's corporate income tax on corporations that didn't pay their CEO more than 100 times what they paid their average employee. and would raise taxes on corporations that did pay their CEO more than 100 times what they paid their average employee. And then it, you know, got higher and higher if it was 200 times, 300 times. And we know in the Fortune 500, it's over 300 times what a corporation makes. So I think you can use the whole corporate tax issue to throw a spotlight on and raise the issue of the huge economic inequality. I think right now, as you know, Social Security and Medicare are funded by the payroll tax, which is actually a tax that more Americans pay than the income tax. It's a hugely regressive tax. I think the Republicans are probably going to come out, some of them, for reducing the payroll tax. I think the Democrats should beat them to a punch by suggesting Social Security should be funded by a greatly reduced payroll tax and a tax on investment income, which is the only kind of income that's rising in this country and which is disproportionately paid by wealthy Americans as opposed to the payroll tax, which is disproportionately paid by poorer Americans. Then I think, the one government program that Americans do support expanding at this juncture is, as this poll in the Wall Street Journal suggests, spending on infrastructure, which our infrastructure is not exactly in great shape and continues to deteriorate each year, something that the federal government is ignoring. And so I would think the Democrats should run on that as well, and maybe that the idea of an infrastructure bank, which can have public funds but then be matched by private funds and fund a lot of job-creating construction. So those are just some ideas, but I think they hit that sweet spot of addressing people's sense that the economy is rigged against them on the one hand, except in the case of infrastructure, doing the kind of government expansion that for the moment is really politically problematic.
Yeah, that's a very interesting program of action there. Let's talk a little more about the payroll tax. I've heard some people suggesting, part of why it's so regressive, obviously it's regressive because you're taxing labor as opposed to taxing capital. So that's, people who have to work for a living get slammed with it, and people who are getting their stock dividends don't have to pay the payroll tax on that. But isn't the payroll tax even more regressive because it's capped at whatever it is, after you make $52,000, then you don't have to pay any more in the payroll?
Well, it's higher than that. It's
higher than that
now,
but there's a cap.
But it really, it really means it hits the poor because, there's no way out of not paying it if you have a job. It hits the poor and the middle class. It doesn't even really hit the upper middle class, let alone anyone wealthier than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, what do you think about removing the cap altogether?
I'd be in favor of removing the cap altogether, but then I'd still reduce the rate, since it's mm-hmm. still a fairly stiff tax on low wage people in particular. So I would reduce the rate. I would raise the ceiling, but I would also try to really shift the burden of funding Social Security and Medicare to investment income, not just on payroll income.
Very good. That sounds like a great plan. And now, as we know, we've got the new leadership team in the House and the Senate just voted on this week. And the Senate leader, Harry Reid, has created a new position for Elizabeth Warren, focusing on messaging and policy. Maybe Elizabeth Warren in her new role could pick up this wonderful platform that you're recommending.
Well, if you see her, tell her. I would hope so, but I would think that these should be policies that a lot of Democrats would want to run with. You have Sherrod Brown as, I think, the ranking Democrat on Senate banking. You have Sandy Levin in the House as a ranking Democrat on Ways and Means, which is the Tax Committee. I would like to see those Democrats and many others pick up some of these ideas too.
Right, and we've got
to mention the Democrat who is still very significant, who lives at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Obama still has State of the Union addresses to give. He still has an annual budget to propose. You know, I don't see any reason why these ideas would be non-starters for the president.
Right, and it'd be nice for him coming down the home stretch to not just be on the sidelines, but to be on the front lines of really making this kind of economic change to help the average American here. And you referenced earlier the announcement that President Obama will be making tonight. So let's talk a little bit about that and about immigration reform. And we're all expecting the new executive order on immigration. You wrote a very moving op-ed in the Washington Post today about immigration reform. Why don't you tell us, you know, what is the president's plan that we can expect tonight? Who is it going to help, and why do you support it?
Well, I mean, I support it because I think we have a crazy policy of having a whole class of people in this country who've been here for a long time. The Pew Research Center estimates that the average undocumented immigrant has lived in the United States for 11 years. So they, we're not talking about people who just crossed the border on Tuesday. You know, keeping them from legal status creates all kinds of lives in the shadows, not just for them, but for their American citizen kids. It makes it, it really kind of drives down wages across the board in working class jobs, because there's always someone, there's often someone who, you know, can be cheated out of his or her wage and is too frightened to complain, which is a real factor in parts of the economy and lowering incomes. It just denies human rights, and it separates families. And that's, the, I think, the key point that I don't think has been stressed enough about the executive order that Obama will announce this evening. And that is, this is mainly an order that affects the parents, the undocumented parents of kids who are American citizens, kids who were born here. It's a family unification program. And, you know, the people, what exactly do the people who oppose this propose to do? Let's look at this seriously. The Republicans have had every chance in the House to bring to a vote the bill that passed the Senate with bipartisan support, 68 votes, 18 months ago. Which would have created a not very easy path to legalization for the 11 million undocumented immigrants. And they haven't even brought it to a vote. So let's assume two things. One, that this will continue to be the Republican position. And two, well, three things. Two, that the rate of deportations at about 400,000 a year will continue, and three, the first Congress to take office after the redistricting of the next census, which may not be as gerrymandered as the current district system that the Republicans largely put in place after the 2010 census, that Congress will take office in 2023. Maybe that is the first plausible time that you could see Democrats controlling both houses of the Senate. So how many families are going to be broken up between today and 2023 if we don't give legal status to the parents of American citizen kids? I mean, you know, come on, get real. That's one thing. And what I also want to know, I mean, people who are opposed to this, do they take the position that we should deport the parents but keep the kids who have never lived in the country to which the parents are being deported, keep the kids here? Are they willing to bring them into their homes and tell them why their parents should have been deported? I mean, you know, this is a problem just crying out for the kind of solution that Obama is going to announce this evening.
And how many people is this going to affect? Is this 11 million people that would be impacted, or how many?
No, it does two things mainly, as I understand it. It affects the parents, the undocumented parents of kids who are American citizens, which is, I think, about 3.5 million.
Three and a half.
And it extends the category of kids labeled as dreamers who were brought here as children without documentation. He is already, he's already given a special status to, I think, about a million such young people, and this would expand that status by somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000. So I think something on the order of 4.5 million of the 11 million undocumented immigrants would be affected, as I understand it, by the president's impending order.
Okay, so that's, you know, it's a big step, and it's not addressing all immigrants, but it's addressing the ones whose, you know, kids were born here or extending the current dreamers. Now, what do you say to the Republicans who are afraid that this is going to now allow, in their view, millions of illegal immigrants to become legal residents? You know, they're worried about increased crime and increased drain on our welfare system, you know, all the reasons that the Republicans are going to be having a big backlash against this. And what's your answer to them?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, in terms of drain on welfare, every study has shown that the rate of employment among these immigrants is higher than that of native-born whites. People come here to work, and they come here to flee horrific levels of violence in home countries like Honduras. There's not much chance of that. Obama is also going to, as I understand it, his policy will say that these immigrants that he is giving legal status to are not eligible for a lot of federal programs, certainly not Obamacare federal medical insurance. So, it's not really expanding the American welfare state, so far as I understand it. I think these are largely bogus arguments that conceal Republicans' fear of expanding the rising American electorate that we spoke of earlier.
Mm-hmm. Well, I interviewed Heather Booth last week, and she's been, as you know, very involved in the immigration reform movement. Her sense is that as soon as the president announces what he's doing for immigration reform, there's going to be a huge backlash, you know, tougher, stronger, more vehement even than the backlash against Obamacare. Is that your expectation?
Well, to a certain degree, it's already begun.
Mm-hmm.
You can already see signs of it. I think most of the coverage of this has dealt with the politics of it. I think, once again, the administration has not done a great job of messaging. This is about keeping parents with their kids, which I don't think most Americans are really all that against. The Republicans, most of the writing has been about, is this circumventing Congress? Is this a good move? Well, there are a lot of constitutional scholars who argue that it clearly is within the president's power to determine who the immigration officials should prioritize for deportation and who they should let in. And the fact is that after the amnesty, as it was called, enacted in 1986 that President Reagan signed into law, they went back a couple years later and by executive order simply made it clear that where there was one a person in a family that had been legalized by this bill, but where there was one person who was undocumented, that person should be allowed to stay. I mean, really, Obama's doing the identical thing that Reagan did. The economy wasn't as bad in 1986, 87, 88 for most people as it is now. That creates, some anxiety. And then the media just hasn't really focused on the whole theme of what this really is doing, is letting American kids keep their parents in America, which is, I think, a pretty straightforward point that most people could understand. It's why I felt the need to write the column I wrote in the Post today, because this is the storyline that somehow has gotten eclipsed by all the other stuff.
Right. I thought it was great the way you went right to the heart of the matter. So, you know, there's going to be, and already is, some kickback among members of Congress. There's, you know, some members of the Republicans in Congress saying, well, if the president is going ahead with this immigration reform, considering we're going to withhold the budget or just pass a, you know, budget for a short-term basis to, and use that as a negotiating tool to, you know, get what they want. More talk of government shutdown, and it doesn't seem like we have quite the intensity that we had with the Tea Party, who were elected in 2010, and yet there's still some of them are still there. There's other ones now have joined them. What do you see happening in Congress now that we've got Republicans starting in January will control both the House and the Senate? What do you see as their agenda, and what can progressives do to limit the damage there? Or do you think people shouldn't have heard this said, that progressives should focus more at the states now than at the federal level, given that the Republicans will be controlling the House and the Senate for the next 2 years?
Well, I mean, I think the Republican leadership has made it clear to their members in Congress and their incoming members as well that the Republicans suffered majorly from the government shutdowns of a year and a half ago, and they don't want to go there again. So we shall see who prevails. I mean, a lot of the Republican base is just in a almost an existential hissy fit, I guess, seems to want to act regardless of consequence to their own party. So we shall see. I think the work that, you know, progressives need to do over the next 2 years, it needs to go on at all levels. It needs to go on at the state level. It needs to go on in the question of what programs we want the National Party and its presidential candidate and its all its candidates in 2016 to run on, how they can try to reconnect with the American people on economic issues. I think that's really the critical task for progressives as we move into the 2016 campaign.
Well said. And that's all the time we have. Harold Morrison, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your great work.
Well, thank you, Eleanor. It's a pleasure to be here.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.